here we go. Today we are going to be talking about the Armenian Quarter and Hartzion and Mount Zion. Okay, so we have this very nice portrait here of Hartzion, right? Looking from across the valley, below Mount Zion is the Hinnom Valley, Gibbon Hinnom. This is the mountain up on top. And we're going to be looking at two different places that are adjacent to each other, Mount Zion and the Armenian Quarter, right? And both of them are in some respects different than the rest of the old city. And Mount Zion is not one of the quarters. It's kind of inside the old city, but not inside the old city. And we'll see that it's not within the walls, or at least it's not within the Ottoman Turkish walls. It was within the walls at certain times in history. It's got a lot of places that are significant for Jews, for Christians, for Muslims. It's got a lot of its own story. So it's not considered one of the quarters, but it does have a lot of history and a lot of connections into the old city. The Armenians, we're only going to get to at the end, right? We're going to spend quite a bit of time in and around Hartzion, but we are going to get to the Armenians. The Armenian Quarter is the one quarter. If you've been in the old city, you know that you can go in and out. There's no boundaries between the quarters. The Armenian Quarter is the only one that's really very separated. It's its own compound. It has a wall around it. You can go into various parts, right? There's a major church. We'll see a map of it. There's a museum that's just reopened, but in general, it's only, it's off limits for everybody except for the Armenians who live there. And the Armenians in general don't mix, don't intermarry, don't sell their property to other groups. So for example, there are Jews who have property in the Christian quarter and then the Muslim quarter, not in the Armenian quarter. So we'll get to them, but we're going to start with Hartzion, with Mount Zion. All right. So let's understand where we are in general. Okay. So first, just to understand where the Armenian quarter is in the old city, right? So it's essentially between Jaffa Gate, right? And Zion Gate is the Armenian Quarter. Usually, the only exposure you have to it is if you walk along the road, right, from Jaffa Gate, and you're walking towards the Jewish Quarter, you'll skirt the Armenian Quarter. You'll see it from the outside. You might like peek into the church over here, but in general, you don't have real access to it. And Zion Gate, Mount Zion is outside of Zion Gate, right? So down here, the Armenian quarter, as you can see, is small, right, compared to the Christian quarter, certainly compared to the Muslim quarter. There is an Armenian connection. There are Armenian places in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. There are Armenian shops in the Christian quarter. So it's not like they are only contained in the Armenian quarter, but this is really where they live and their major institutions are. Okay, so that's just to understand what we're talking about. We're talking about the southwestern quarter of the old city. Okay, let's go on. Let's do a little timeline, which we always like to do, right? We'll look at the map at a certain point. Don't worry, but just to get a general sense, right? By the end of the first temple period, meaning by 700 before the Common Era, the walls of the city reach all the way to Mount Zion, right? The city grows till there. And we have graves here, and we're going to discuss, is this the grave of King David? Is the grave of the kings of the house of David? We'll get to that, right? But that's what we have from First Temple times. Late First Temple times, it's already included within the city walls, okay? And on the very edge, we have this grave site, okay? Second Temple times, in the very beginning, in Shivat Zion, in the return to Zion, Mount Zion is outside, but by the time we get to the time period of the Hasmoneans and later to Herod, Mount Zion is within the city walls. Maybe there's a synagogue here. You're going to see there's a lot of question marks on this timeline because there are a lot of question marks about Mount Zion. There has been some archaeology here, but not enough. Byzantine period, right, when the Roman Empire becomes Christian. These terms should be already somewhat familiar to us by our third class here. We have a large church on Mount Zion called the Hagia Sion Church, none of which is existing anymore. And we have the beginnings of the Armenian community in Jerusalem. They are around for a long time. They start coming to Jerusalem already in the fourth century. with the Crusaders, right, the second major important Christian period, we have a very important Christian structure that's built on Mount Zion, not built, but kind of ascribed to, meaning is ascribed to it on Mount Zion, and that's the room of the Last Supper, the Cenaculum, right? The Franciscans, right? The Catholics established their center on Mount Zion. The Armenians build their major cathedral. So a lot of development in this Crusader time period. After the Crusaders leave and the Jews come back to Jerusalem, we have the Ramban, we have Nachmanides, who establishes a Jewish neighborhood, maybe on Mount Zion, maybe in the Jewish quarter. Again, question marks, right? We know that the Ramban, that Nachmanides comes to Jerusalem, reestablishes, creates, makes a synagogue out of an existing building, brings Torah scrolls back. The question is, does he come to what we today call the Beit Knesset HaRamban, right? The synagogue of the Ramban in the Jewish quarter, or does he first come to Mount Zion and at some point they move into the Jewish quarter? Ottoman period, 16th century, the Franciscans are thrown off of Mount Zion. They have to move to the Christian quarter. The Muslims take over the whole area of David's tomb. Jews and Christians are forbidden to enter. The Cenaculum is turned into a mosque, right? The whole area, which had been Jewish and Christian, is now completely Muslim. Muslim family, the Dajani family, become the caretakers of the tomb. 19th century, Christians start coming back, right? And this should be a theme that we're already getting from last time, and we'll see it again in the Muslim quarter, that there's a period where the Christians are kicked out of everywhere except for their own quarter. And then the 19th century, they start to come back to various places. So the Dormition church is built. There's a Protestant school called the Bishop Gobat School. We'll come back to all these places. Very important dates for Armenians, starting in World War I and up until 1923. We have the terrible, terrible massacre of the Armenians by the Turks, the Armenian genocide, which also means that you have even more Armenians who are coming to the Holy Land, survivors. And that's a very important experience, important milestone in Armenian history. A terrible, tragic milestone in Armenian history. In 1948, with the War of Independence, Israel loses the old city, but we retain Mount Zion. It stays in Israeli hands, and we'll talk about that between 48 and 67. Mount Zion is super important for Israel. Okay, it becomes a Jewish center on Mount Zion. So we're going to come back to all of these things, but just to keep them in mind. Okay, so yeah, we'll talk about why the Armenians come when we get to the Armenians. Don't worry. Okay, by the way, sources, they're not so many. There's the timeline and there's a couple of other sources. So if you want to have them, they are on the website page, I believe. So just to know. Okay, where will we be going on Mount Zion? Okay, so let's understand where we are and where are we going. Okay, so hold on. Just want to move this out of the way. Okay. Here's Zion Gate. Okay. This is the entrance into the old city. The Armenian quarter is inside. But on Mount Zion, we're going to be talking about King David's tomb, right? So this is outside the walls. The walls of the old city are over here. We are outside the walls. The Armenian quarter is inside the walls. We're going to be in King David's tomb. Very, very important. We're also going to talk about the Dormition and the Franciscans and the Armenian cemetery and the Greek Orthodox cemetery that are out here, right? We're going to come down here to the Jerusalem University College. And we're also going to mention a little bit the Protestant cemetery and Oscar Schindler's grave, which is all the way at the bottom of the hill, right? It's not on the mountain itself, but it's at the bottom of the hill. Okay, so that's just to understand where we are and what we're talking about. Bottom down here is Gay Ben Hinnom, is the Ben Hinnom Valley. And across is Yamin Moshe, right? The neighborhoods outside the walls. Also interesting to notice on this map here on Google Maps, they tell you the armistice line from 1949, right? So what does that mean? Don't mind my messy drawing. That means Jews are over here, right, on this side, and the rest is Jordanian. So Mount Zion, very interesting, weird exception to the whole story of the old city and the old city being in Jordanian hands. Okay, so Now that we've squiggled all over everything, we can carry on. Okay, so let's understand where we are in terms of the city itself. Okay, so Mount Zion is outside. Hold on, let's again annotate. Will be helpful for us. Okay, so remember we talked about the growth of the city, right? City starts like this, grows to be this size in the time of King Solomon and the temple. By the time we get to King Hezekiah, the city grows all the way out to Jaffa Gate. But unlike today's city, which the line in the wall is over here, First Temple City goes all the way down and around back to the city of David. So Mount Zion, which is sort of around here, right, is within the walls of the city at a certain point, right? Not before, but by the time we get to very late First Temple times, which is going to be important for us in understanding who's buried here, when are they buried here, right? Because we're really kind of far away from the city of David. So just keep that in mind. We'll get to it a little later. By Second Temple times, the same thing, right? By the time of the story of Hanukkah, the Hasmoneans, we're including this whole area, and it stays inside of the city of Jerusalem in Herodian times when the city grows to the north, and at the very end of Bayitshani times when the city grows all the way far to the north, right? But always Mount Zion and this whole area is within the walls of the city, right? And essentially, it's only 1,000 years ago, okay, that this area is cut off from the rest of the city, right? About 1,000 years ago, when there are Muslim rulers called the Abbasids in Jerusalem, there's an earthquake. They have to repair the walls. And at that point, they say, you know what? It's a real pain to make the walls go all the way down to the valley. We're going to cut off that bottom part and make the walls up here. Okay. So that's a major change to the city. But up until 1,000 years ago, Mount Zion is within the walls of the city. So 1,000 years ago is not nothing, but it does mean that there was a change at a certain point. Okay, so here we have something very nice. Not so long ago, about 10 years ago, the city of Jerusalem doing various road works and salvage excavations, and they excavated below Mount Zion, right at the bottom. People who are a little familiar with Jerusalem, you may know that there's a road, right? The road that takes you towards the parking lot of Mount Zion. Below is the Hinnom Valley, right? So this is right below that road. And what did they discover when they excavated here? And this is why excavating is so important, but we can't always do it in an organized fashion. They discovered a wall, right? Here's this nice wall with a turn, right? This is the wall that goes back to Byzantine Jerusalem, meaning 1,500 years ago. Okay, this was the wall of the city below Mount Zion, right? Let's go back one just to get a sense of what we're talking about. Hold on. Can I go back? No? Hey. Sorry. I want to go back. No, back. Okay. Sorry for all the drawing, right? The wall of the city went all the way down here. So this is what we're talking about. We found a piece of this wall. So now let's go back one. Okay. So here's our wall of the city in Byzantine times. Okay. But then they continued to excavate and they found another wall where this young woman is standing. And this wall goes back to Hasmonean times. Okay. So just to understand what we're talking about, this is the top wall is give or take 450 of the common era. The bottom wall is 150 before the common era. Okay, so more than 500 years separate these two walls. As you can see, they're more or less built in the same way, but the Byzantines who built this wall did not see this wall, right? There's a lot of dirt between them. And when they continue to excavate below the Hasmonean wall, they found a wall that goes back to First Temple times in exactly the same place, which is pretty wild. And we've seen this in other places as well. If it's a place that's logical to build a wall 1500 years ago, it was logical 2200 years ago, and it was logical 2700 years ago. But it's rare that you get to see it all in a row so nicely here. So this was just really a great discovery, helping us to understand the walls around the city, the topography, why it was important to build walls here. So this is something you can still go see today. And it's just so neat the way that it lines up so perfectly. Okay, back up to Zion Gate. Okay, the gate itself, as we saw a little bit in the map, leads directly into the street that's right next to the Armenian Quarter on the one side, and it's going towards the Jewish Quarter on the other side. Okay. All the gates in Jerusalem have more than one name. Almost have more than one name. This one is no exception. It's called Shaar Tzion, or Zion Gate, in Hebrew and English, but the Arabs have two different names for it. They call it Bab Nabi Daoud, or the Gate of Hanavi David, right? King David, or the Prophet David, because they know it's near King David's tomb. They also call it Bab Charat Al Yahud, the Gate of the Jewish Quarter, meaning they associate it with the entrance into the Jewish Quarter, because it is very close to the Jewish Quarter. And in fact, today, when you have tourists who are coming and their buses let them off, they want to go towards the Jewish Quarter or towards the Kotel, they will often go in through this gate. Now, this gate, as you can see, it's not quite as grand. We're going to see, we do the Muslim Quarter, we're going to see Damascus Gate. It's much fancier. Jaffa Gate is fancier. This is not such a fancy gate, but it does have something very interesting about it, and that's all these pockmarks all over it. Okay, these are sniper marks from 1948. We're going to talk about the fighters of the Palmach breaking into the old city in May of 1948 to help the besieged defenders of the Jewish Quarter. When the walls and the gates were restored by the city of Jerusalem like 5 years ago, they retained these pockmarks because it's part of the story, right? It's part of history. This is the nice sign that tells us where we are. Just one other thing that's interesting. In the 19th century, in the early 19th century, outside of Zion Gate, we know that there was a leper colony, right? Leper, which is not really tzaraat, it's called Hansen's disease. But lepers were always considered outcasts, and they had to live outside the city, and they lived in very, very miserable conditions. They were beggars. Nobody wanted to have anything to do with them. And then there were Christian groups that actually started hospitals and homes for lepers. But in the beginning, they lived outside of Zion Gate. In 1948, as we said, we have two very important things that happen. The Jewish Quarter is besieged in the War of Independence. It's besieged for 6 full months, more than any other place, from the very beginning of the War of Independence on November 30th, 1948, until the surrender on May 28th, 1948. The Jewish Quarter is a siege within a siege, right? Jerusalem is besieged in general because the road to Jerusalem is attacked by Arabs on the way. Supplies are not coming to Jerusalem, but the Jewish Quarter is in the old city, surrounded by Arabs all around, so they're even in worse shape. You also have a very small and rather vulnerable population of Jews in the Jewish Quarter, right? If you had 100,000 Jews in Jerusalem in 1948, only 2,000 of them lived in the old city. A lot of families, old people, very ultra-Orthodox people, not really fighters, although they became fighters despite themselves. They had no choice. And May of 1948 is the most difficult month of the entire War of Independence. There's fighting all over the country. And whether this was justified or not, the Israeli underground movements, right, we don't have an IDF just yet, did not give enough forces to the old city. On May 18th, they broke through the gate. The Palmach arrived, and this is this memorial sign that's right near the gate. The Palmach arrived. They set explosives because the gate, of course, was closed and guarded. They set explosives. They broke through the gate. They brought ammunition, and they, more importantly, brought, like, wow, moral support, and we're going to have relief to the fighters of the Jewish Quarter. But they left almost immediately afterwards because there were so many places that needed fighters. And this is something that's been argued about many times. Were they justified in doing that? Should they have stayed? Could they have possibly saved the Jewish Quarter? Whatever the answer is, 10 days later, May 28th, Friday afternoon, the Jewish Quarter surrenders to the Jordanian army because they really have no choice. They're completely surrounded. They don't know what their fate is going to be. The men are sent as prisoners of war to Jordan. The women, the children, some of the old people are sent outside of Zion Gate. And that's the picture that you have here. And they're sent into exile in order to and they're sent into exile in New Jerusalem. Right? I see somebody asked, why would you shoot at a wall? You didn't shoot at a wall. They wanted to break into the gate, which was closed. And they set explosives to blow the gate open. Right. So you had attacks, you had shooting, you had bullets, you had bombs in order to break in. But it did not help. And May 28th, the Jews are sent into exile from the Jewish quarter, not knowing when they're going to return. We know they came back 19 years later, but they did not know that at the time. And it's just another example of Jews going into exile. Okay, let's go to King David's tomb, because King David's tomb is probably the most important site on Mount Zion. It's the reason that Jews, Christians, and Muslims are connected to Mount Zion, because each of them sees David as holy in different ways. So for Jews, of course, King David is the most righteous king. He's the father of the dynasty, the Davidic dynasty. He's the ancestor of the Messiah, right? King David, very, very important. And for Christians, we're going to see, right, David is connected to Jesus, right? And Jesus, of course, is the Messiah. So they want to be connected to King David. And the Muslims see David as a prophet as well. So everybody wants to be connected to King David. The question is this David's tomb, right? It's an old joke, right? Who's buried in David's tomb? Maybe not David, right? So we have some verses that talk about where various kings were buried, right? Number one is King David. So David slept with his fathers and he was buried in the city of David. Okay. Now we know that the city of David is not here. And in fact, when David dies, this Mount Zion is far outside the city. Why would you bury all the way out here instead of going into the Kidron Valley? So it's pretty far away. It seems unlikely that this is David's tomb, although there are scholars who will say, no, no, no. City of David is not the term that we use today for the city of David. And it's very possible that this was called the city of David. There are people who suggest that this is David's tomb, but there are others who suggest otherwise. And there's something very interesting. If you look at the verses that talk about where the various kings are buried, right? David is buried in the city of David. Solomon is buried in the city of his father, David. Chizkiyahu, right? A couple of generations, quite a lot of generations later, right? About 200 years later, Chizkiyahu slept with his fathers and was buried on the upper part of the tomb of the sons of David. Ah, wait a second. What does that mean? Where is that? Unclear. And then we have Menasseh. Right? Menasseh, Chizkiyahu's son. Menasseh slept with his fathers and was buried in the garden of his palace, in the garden of Uzzah, right? A place called Gan Uzzah. So what seems to be happening here is that the place of the tombs changes at some point, right? David is buried in one place, Solomon, Rehavam, et cetera, they're all buried in the same place. And then when we come to Chizkiyahu, to Hezekiah, and to his descendants, there's a shift, right? Maybe because the city grows. Maybe now we're not going to bury all the way down in the Kidron Valley, but we're going to bury near the Hinnom Valley. And maybe that's what the tomb of David is. Maybe it's not the tomb of David. Maybe it's the tomb of David's descendants, right? And that's a suggestion in the scholarship. Maybe. We, again, don't have proof. Has anybody ever attempted to excavate down here? Yes, they have. Okay. So in the 19th century, you have this interesting Italian adventurer whose name is Pierotti. He's the guy on the left. Okay. And in 1859, when there are renovations that are being done in the tomb, in 1859, remember, the Ottoman Turks are in charge. They're not really allowing too much access to Jews or to Christians, certainly not to archaeologists. But somehow he gets in, right? My video gone? Why is my video gone? No, no. Sorry. Hold on. To see why this is not working. Ah, here we are. Okay.
It's working.
Now it's working. I see. Somehow he manages to get into the tomb. He goes down. He finds a cave. He draws a picture of it. It seems like it's some kind of a burial cave, right? Do we trust him? Is he reliable? It's an interesting question, but it could be, right? And then almost 100 years later, 1948, all right, War of Independence. During the War of Independence, a shell explodes near the tomb. A few years later, 1951, Israel is in control of Mount Zion and of the tomb of David, right, of David's tomb. And there's an Israeli archaeologist named Yaakov Finkerfeld, and this is him on the right. And he does a survey. And under the building that exists today, he finds a few layers. He finds a Crusader building. Under that, he finds a Roman building, a late Roman period building. Under that, he finds an earlier Roman period building, which seems to be oriented towards the Temple Mount. Could this be an ancient synagogue? Could it be a Jewish Christian church? Could it be something to commemorate these ancient tombs? Very interesting question. We don't really know. And until you could do more excavations, which is probably not happening anytime soon, we won't really know. But it is a very fascinating question. Yaakov Finkerfeld, by the way, unfortunately was killed in a Jordanian attack on the kibbutz of Ramat Rachel. There was an archaeological conference there in 1956, and snipers from over the border shot at the archaeologists. Five of them were killed. Yaakov Finkerfeld was one of them. So this is our question about Hartzion, about David's tomb. Another suggestion, right? So if King David is not buried there, where indeed is he buried? So in the early 20th century, there was a French Jewish archaeologist whose name was Raymond Weil, and he, along with many other people, excavated in the city of David, and he found a quarry, right, a Roman quarry, but he also found these kind of interesting caves, and he said maybe this is the tomb of King David that was kind of cut up and destroyed when the Romans made quarries here. We have no proof that it is. We have no proof that it isn't. It doesn't look like First Temple period burial caves, but maybe something was wrecked here. We don't have any great proof. But when he did this excavation, he actually found something else that was very interesting. And that's the inscription that you see on the right, which you might be able to see is in Greek, right? This is called the Theodotus inscription. This is an inscription that is from late Second Temple times, right? From the first century of the Common Era. And it talks about a guy, people who took the synagogue course, we talked about this, talks about a guy named Theodotus, who is the Archisynagogus. And he's the son of an Archisynagogus. And he's the grandson of an Archisynagogus. What's an Archisynagogus? He's the guy who runs the synagogue, as in we would call him the Gabbai, right? But it tells us we have a synagogue in the city of David, meaning a 10-minute walk from the Temple Mount, right? But there were synagogues contemporary with the Temple Mount. So that's a very interesting inscription. It has nothing to do with King David, but it's nice to know about. Okay, let's go back to King David's tomb. When the Jews and the Christians are kicked out in the 16th century in Ottoman times, there's a Muslim family, one of the important Muslim families, one of the old Muslim families in Jerusalem, the Dajani family, who are appointed the guardians of the tomb. Okay, and they had their whole own compound here. They had a lot of buildings. They had three different cemeteries. This is one of their cemeteries here on the right. So much wanted to protect King David's tomb that they actually would show visitors a fake tomb to mislead them from the real one. Okay. The Dajanis were the first mayor of Jerusalem in 1863 was a Dajani. This distinguished looking gentleman here is someone named Arif Pasha al-Dajani. He was the mayor of Jerusalem during World War I. So they were very important. One of the things that happened after 1948 is that the Dajani family was basically kicked out because the Jews took over here, right? One of the many population transfers that happened on both sides. Jews kicked out of areas that the Jordanians took over. Non-Jews kicked out of the areas that the Jews took over. So that's what happened to the Dajani family. The area of King David's tomb, as we mentioned before, is important to everybody. And it's visually just very powerful to see this. When you go there today, you can see the minaret on the top floor. This is a mosque that used to be here. Not here anymore. The second floor is the cenaculum, is the room of the Last Supper, very important to Christians. And the bottom floor is King David's tomb, which has become a Jewish shrine, even though it's important to the other groups as well, right? But it's a great example of something we see over and over and over in Israel, which is that everybody wants the same place. Everything is holy to everybody because so many of our stories are shared stories. All right. So this is something we talked about in the first class. We'll just mention it quickly. The room of the Last Supper, we have stories in the Gospels, in a few of the Gospels, that talk about Jesus and his disciples coming to Jerusalem for Passover, right? For a Pesach Seder, they need a place to actually be. They find this place, and here you have the version of the story in Luke, right? He finds a house, and he says, where's the room where I can have Passover with my disciples, right? And this is a very significant story, because this is the story where Jesus, A, tells his disciples that one of them is going to betray him, and he also talks to them about the bread and the wine, or the body and the blood, right? Very important in the Catholic Church. This room, the Cenaculum, the Last Supper room, the structure that you see here is from Crusader times, but it might be that there's an even earlier version from Byzantine times. We're not sure who built what when, but this is clearly something that was Crusader and was taken over by the Muslims. Today, tons and tons of Christian groups come to visit here. There are no actual prayer services that happen here, right? The Israeli government does not allow prayer services here. There's a big controversy with the Vatican, fighting back and forth. But at the moment, there's no prayers here unless it's like a special occasion. As you can see, this is a room that was fought over by different religions, right? One of the decorations in the room, you can see this picture here on the left. This is a pelican, right? Can you see the pelican? I don't know if you can see the pelican, right? Here's the pelican. Here's the pelican mom. All right. And the pelican mom is being pecked at by the pelican babies, because this was this belief that the pelican babies survive by eating the flesh of the mother. Some mothers here may identify with this. And Christians see the pelican as a symbol of Jesus, right? The young eats its flesh, and then the pelican comes back to life. So this is a Christian symbol that's from Crusader times. Okay. But off on the other side of the room, you have a mihrab, right? This is a picture here on the right. You have the Muslim prayer direction that is a clear symbol of a mosque. So when the Mamluks and then the Ottomans kick out the Crusaders, they turn this building that was clearly a church into a mosque, and they put their symbol here. This is something that we see over and over again in Jerusalem, in Israel in general. Back to our 1948 story. Okay. So in the battles of 1948, we lose the old city, but we manage to retain control of Mount Zion, which is kind of a strange thing, but we're able to hold on to it. And you can actually see, when you walk to King David's tomb, you can see the Sephardic synagogue of Mount Zion established during the War of Independence, which is kind of wild. Like, while all the other synagogues in the Jewish quarter are being blown up or desecrated by the Jordanians, this is a new synagogue that's established on Mount Zion. And Mount Zion becomes this place of memory. It becomes a place of holiness. It becomes a place of pilgrimage, because it's the only place that you can go to, right? Jews are not allowed to go to the Western Wall. Jews are not allowed to go to the Jewish Quarter or to the cemetery on the Mount of Olives. The only place they can go that's close to the old city is Mount Zion. And so it takes on many different roles in those 19 years. So if you go up to the roof above the Room of the Last Supper, there is one of a number of memorials to the fighters of the Jewish Quarter, right? Because from up here, you can actually see over to Har HaBayit, to the Temple Mount, and you have the names of the fighters who fought, not just fighters, residents as well, who were killed in the battles of the Jewish Quarter. All right. And that's what's up on the roof. Okay. In the War of Independence and right afterwards, Mount Zion was isolated, right? Because there was Jewish Jerusalem on one side of the Hinnom Valley, and there was Mount Zion on the other side of the Hinnom Valley, but the Hinnom Valley itself was no man's land. So how did you access, how did you provide supplies to the soldiers who were stationed on Mount Zion? So for about 6 months in 1948, there was a crazy thing, which you can go see today. There was a guy named Uriel Chefetz who put up, obviously with the army's knowledge and assistance, put up a cable cable car. You know, think of a cable car. Do not think of like, you know, Masada or even Rosh HaNichrah. This is like a tiny little rusty metal thing, which as you can see, Bikoshi like could hold two people, but they would use it to bring supplies or to transport people if absolutely necessary from one side of the Hinnom Valley to the other, but it needed to be kept secret. So what they would do is during the day, they would slacken the cable so that it was down in the valley and nobody could see it, and they would only use it at night. It was not very practical. It wasn't very big. It could be discovered at any moment. You could shoot at it, right? Not a very good idea. It's abandoned after about 6 months, but nobody knows about it until the 1970s, right? And this is part of that whole culture in Israel of the War of Independence and of the army in general. We don't talk about things that we don't need to talk about. Today, you can go, if anybody knows where the Mount Zion Hotel is or the Cinematheque, right, on the western side of Gay Ben Hinnom, there's actually a very little but very nice museum about the cable car. And you could actually see the cable car is back up again, and it's kind of cool. But back to Mount Zion itself, right? So because you can't go to any of the places that are in the Jewish quarter or, of course, to the Kotel or the Temple Mount, Mount Zion becomes this pilgrimage site, right? Particularly when on the second, what in the diaspora is the second day of Shavuot, what in Israel is Isru Chag, the day after Shavuot, Zion Sivan. Why? Because according to tradition, that is the day that King David was born, and that is the day that he died. So you're going to come to his tomb. So people would make the not particularly safe journey, right, across the no man's land of Gay Ben Hinnom, up the steps to the top of Mount Zion to go to King David's tomb. Very, very significant. And all kinds of like stories and connections develop around King David's tomb. And of course, you have the connection to the Messiah, right? To the redemption. One day King David's going to return. The Messiah is going to come. We'll be able to return to all these places. So that's definitely part of the whole story. The picture you see on the right is a room on top of King David's tomb, which was known as Cheder HaNasi, or the room of the president. The second president of Israel, Yitzhak Ben Tzvi, was not only a very important Zionist activist, and he became the second president. He did all kinds of things to build up the country, but he was a scholar. He was a scholar of Jewish history. He knew a lot of Torah, and he would come to Mount Zion. He had this like room set aside for him, and he would come there to pray, to think, to study. He wanted to be close to the old city. Now, another thing that developed on Mount Zion in those years, and this is a fascinating place, if you ask people what's the first Holocaust museum in the world, people who know a little bit about it will say Yad Vashem. That is incorrect. The very first Holocaust museum in the world is what's called the Chamber of the Holocaust, or Martef HaShoah. And it's on Mount Zion. It's not really a museum. It's much more of a memorial. So right after the War of Independence, the very beginnings of the State of Israel, there is a man named Shmuel Zalman Kahana, and he is the Sar HaDatot, right? He's the head of the religion ministry. His father was a dayan, was a judge in the Beit Din in Warsaw. They managed to get out during the war. They came, they were in the old city, they were kicked out of the old city, and he decides that there needs to be some kind of a Holocaust memorial. Now, realize that Israel in those very early years basically doesn't want to hear about the Holocaust, right? They don't want to hear from the survivors. They don't want to know. They think of them as these Nebuch diaspora Jews who went like sheep to the slaughter. The survivors themselves don't necessarily want to talk about things or think about things. They want to become, you know, new Israelis, leave everything behind. And there's no real place for memory, right? And memory is very tricky, and we want to remember. How do we do it? And Shmuel Kahana says, let's make a memorial site on Mount Zion. Why on Mount Zion? First of all, it's the only place that's at least somewhat connected to the holy places. Number two, it's connected to King David, and redemption is certainly something we want to connect with the Holocaust. And number three, we have a verse in the Book of Ovadia that talks about the refuge, right? The refugees will be on Mount Zion. Ubahar Tzion tiyeh pleita. He says this is going to be the place of a memorial site. And he invites the communities, the survivors from all kinds of communities, right? All the Landsmannschaft, to make their own kind of memorials. And as you can see, it's in no way uniform. And every community made themselves a memorial. And you could have enormous communities like Lublin, and you could have tiny communities that are not even communities, but were like people who were in the same DP camps. And this is the beginnings of this memorial. Little by little, they add all different kinds of things. The focus is on spiritual resistance. It's a fascinating place. Next time you come to Israel, or people who live in Israel, it's a fascinating place. It is as different from Yad Vashem as night from day. They are both very important in very different ways. But this is one of the strange and unusual things that develops on Mount Zion during those 19 years. Okay, so a few other things on Mount Zion. There's also a Christian side to the story. We have a few important churches. We have the Catholic Church of the Dormition here on the left. Okay, Dormition as in dorme, sleeping, right? The belief is that this is where Mary goes to sleep or dies, right? And this is a church that's built in the late 19th century. We'll see more about it in a minute. There's also an Armenian church on Mount Zion, right? Armenian convent, right? You can see it, Kuvent Armenian Sin Savior. They believe that this is the house of Caiaphas. Caiaphas was, according to the Gospels, the Kohen Gadol, the high priest in the time of the crucifixion. We actually have a tomb in the Israel Museum that tells us the name Caiaphas, Yosef ben Caiaphas. And they believe that this is his house, and this is where Jesus was arrested. There's an Armenian cemetery up here. The Dormition was built in the time that Kaiser Wilhelm, right, the head of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, he visits the land of Israel in the late 19th century in 1898. A lot of churches are built in his honor. He actually buys this land. There are those who suggest a similarity between how Kaiser Wilhelm looks and how the church is. Here's the helmet. Here are his eyes. Here's his nose. And here is his fabulous mustache. That's just for fun. Okay, so you can see that. But this is definitely a landmark on Mount Zion. And one last place on Mount Zion, and this is at the edge, right? You have to walk almost to the edge of the hill. You get to a school that today is called the Jerusalem University College. It's a Protestant Jerusalem, the American Institute of Holy Land Studies. It's a Protestant institute for students who want to come and study about Israel, about Bible, different kinds of things. It was founded by a guy named Bishop Gobat, who was the first, not the first, but he was a Protestant bishop of Jerusalem. And he founds this school here. He actually had a summer house in Ein Karim, and that's what this picture is today. It's a place that's been taken over by Messianic Jews. But on the outskirts of the school is a Protestant cemetery, and there are a couple of very famous people who are buried there. One of them is someone named Flinders Petrie, who is one of the earliest and very important archaeologists, Egyptologist. He digs in Egypt. He digs in the land of Israel. So he has the symbol. He has the Egyptian symbol of an Ankh, right? The Egyptian symbol of life on his grave, Flinders Petrie. And there's also the graves of Conrad and Friederike Schick, Conrad Schick and his wife, also very important German Protestant, comes to Jerusalem, does lots of research, does lots of building, very, very interesting character. We will perhaps talk about him a little bit more on a different occasion. And finally, we have a Catholic cemetery. Yeah.
You didn't mention the Diaspora Yeshiva, Rabbi Goldstein's.
It's true. I did not mention it. We could talk about it at the end.
Good enough.
Okay. And we could talk about it at the end. On the slopes of the cemetery is a Catholic cemetery. On the slopes of the mountain, by the way, is a Catholic cemetery. The most important person who's buried there is Oscar Schindler, right? As you can see, a very visited grave in Hebrew, Hasidu Mot HaOlam, right? Righteous Gentile. Lots of people come to visit. Well, not so many, but more people should probably come to visit his grave. And that's where he is buried. But we're finally getting to the Armenians, okay? And Batya, I will talk about the Diaspora Museum, the Diaspora Yeshiva at the end, and I'm happy to have you add. But I did not put pictures in. You are correct. Okay. So the Armenians. Right, so now let's finally go into the Armenian Quarter. As we said, it's a very closed off. There's no access without permission unless you're going into the church. There are around 800 Armenians in the Old City. In Israel in general, there are about 10,000 Armenians. There are Armenian churches in Haifa, in Jaffa, in Ramleh, right? There are Armenians who live in other places, but in the compound itself, not so many, and mostly people who are connected somehow either to the church or stores in the old city, right? So this is just to give a little bit of an idea what's inside the compound itself. Okay, we are going to talk specifically about the library, okay? We are going to talk about the St. James, the cathedral. Those are the two things we're mostly going to talk about. This museum, actually just walked by there today. I did not go in. It has just reopened. It was closed for a very long time. So exciting. But in general, like we said, not a place that you have too much access to. So that's why it's kind of nice to be able to see it even on Zoom. What's the story with the Armenians? Okay, so we have this map just in case you're a little rusty on your geography. Here is Armenia next door to Azerbaijan, but more importantly for our purposes, next door to Turkey. Okay, early on in Christianity, the nation of Armenia converts as a nation. Okay, they convert to Christianity as a nation, and because of that, some Armenians make their way to the land of Israel, right? As somebody said, it's very far away. But if you're converting and Christianity is very important to you, then you are going to go to the place where the stories happened. And there are Armenians who already come in the fourth century, very, very early. They come to Jerusalem. They establish themselves in Jerusalem. Okay? They stay on when the Crusaders come. They marry in with them and they connect with them. And you know, if you have, if you're a veteran, if you stuck around for a long time, you get to hold on to a piece of land. They don't leave, they stay. The tragedy, the terrible, terrible tragedy of the Armenians is that during World War I, the Turks, which is still the Ottoman Empire, by the way, it's not modern Turkey. It's not, which is not so wonderful either, but the Ottoman Empire was truly very cruel. They had a conflict with the Armenians and they murdered 1.5 million of them. Many, many orphans, right? Many children were murdered, but many orphans as well. Some of them make their way somehow incredible ways to the land of Israel. There are Armenians all over. They have a very big diaspora. There's a lot of similarities between the Armenians and the Jews. They have this very large diaspora all over the world. The diaspora helps support the community in Jerusalem. Today, there are about 11 million Armenians in the world, 3 million of them in Armenia. So very interesting. Most Armenians do not live in Armenia. The genocide, right? And we talk about it as a genocide, and it's widely considered by many people to be kind of, the opening the gate to the genocide and the Holocaust, because Hitler supposedly said, who thinks about the Armenians now, right? Nobody cared about the Armenians. Nobody's going to care about the Jews. And that's why it's very tragic that Israel, for various political reasons, doesn't officially acknowledge the Armenian genocide, mostly because we want to have good relations with Turkey, but it really makes no sense because the Turkey of today is not the Ottoman Empire. And this is a controversial issue that comes up, by the way. I believe that unless it's changed, the United States doesn't recognize the Armenian genocide either. So we're not alone, but it doesn't make it right. The holy place for Armenians is Mount Ararat, right? Ararat as in the place where Noah's Ark lands, right? So that's the holy place for them. It's their national symbol. It's their symbol of return. Today it's under Turkish control and there's very little access to it for Armenians, but it's a very significant place for them. Some people suggest that the very distinctive hat of the Armenian priests, which is pointy, as you can see, is meant to resemble Mount Ararat. Okay. As well as this is the entrance to the St. James Cathedral, right? The St. James Cathedral, very significant. And you can see that it's pointy, right? The entrance is also very pointy. James, who's James, right? There are two Jameses. James is the brother of Jesus, who's the first bishop of Jerusalem. James is also an apostle of Jesus. Which one is it? It's both of them, right? The James, the apostle of Jesus, is buried in Spain. It's a place called Santiago de Compostela, also very important for pilgrimages. The Armenians have a lot of worth in the wealth in the church. The church is very, very, you can see lots of bling, lots of wealth, lots of, I wouldn't say lots of power, but definitely lots of wealth and connections to Armenians all over the world. Pilgrims come to visit the church from all over. And when they would come, they don't do it anymore, but when they would come, they would want to leave their mark and they would make these stones, these fancy stones that were incorporated into the wall. Okay. It's called kachkars. You give money and you get to incorporate your stone in the wall. Inside the church, we have these tiles. We're going to talk about the Armenian tiles, but in Armenia, this is a very old, form of artwork, of craftsmanship, making these very beautiful tiles, a lot of blue. We have a very strange story about these particular tiles. In the 18th century, there's the patriarch, the Armenian patriarch is a guy named Gregorius, and he needs to raise money, right? So he goes on a fundraising tour. Always good to go on a fundraising tour. But his fundraising tour is, I don't think, not one that most of us would emulate. He puts big chains on himself and he travels around Armenia with these chains, and people come out and they see him in the chains and they give him money. Right. And they give him so much money that he's able to build a wall around the Armenian compound and to bring these tiles to renovate in the church. So rather odd. Okay. Our last few places that we're going to talk about, inside the compound is a beautiful library. Okay. It's one of the most important Armenian libraries in the world. And it was created by this very dapper gentleman here, whose name is Kalust Gulbekian. He's born in Turkey, but he's educated in France, and he lives out his life in Britain, and he dies in Portugal, right? He's very cosmopolitan, very international. He's born in 1869. He dies in 1955. He makes himself a huge fortune from oil. Okay, he was, he studied engineering. He knew all about oil. He was a scientist and he kind of got in on the ground floor of major oil companies. He was called Mr. 5% because every oil company that he helped to establish, he held on to 5% of the shares. So you can imagine that he made himself a nice bit of money. He was a big art patron. And he was a collector of scholarly books, and he created this library, which has more than 100,000 books. It's one of the most important Armenian libraries in the world. The Armenian language has its own alphabet. That's why I brought you the picture of the typewriter over here. So it's just neat to see that they have different letters. And they have this very, very important library, which they don't give so much access to unless you're like a scholar and you apply, but it does have very, a lot of importance for people who are studying the history of Armenia and the Armenians. And finally, probably the things that are best known about the Armenians are the beautiful ceramic tiles. Okay, so in Armenia, there were these craftspeople that were known for centuries who made these beautiful tiles, and we'll see some great examples of them in a minute. But they were not here in the land of Israel, right? A lot of people think that the Armenian tiles that you see in Jerusalem, you see on the Dome of the Rock, you see them in stores, that they've been here for centuries upon centuries like the Armenians. It's not true. The British governor of Jerusalem, right, in the time of the British Mandate, there was a governor named Ronald Storrs, and he was very into this, it's called the arts and crafts movement, right, trying to kind of encourage local craftsmanship. And he wants to redo the tiles on the Dome of the Rock. So what does he do? He travels to Armenia. He finds three craftsmen who are well known in this craft, who are masters of the craft, and he convinces them to move to the land of Israel. 1925, the Armenian genocide. Armenia is not such a great place to be. He convinces these families to move to Jerusalem. Okay? The Ohanessians, the Balians, and the Karkashians, okay? All of whom, I don't think the Ohanessians, but the Balians and the Karkashians are still working in Armenian tiles. He brings them to Jerusalem. This is David Ohanessian over here. They don't actually redo the tiles on the Dome of the Rock. That project kind of falls through, but David Ohanessian Messian is brought to do the tiles in a beautiful building built in the time of the British called the Rockefeller Museum. And Rockefeller Museum incorporates all kinds of gorgeous sculpture and architecture, and it also incorporates these incredibly intricate and beautiful Armenian tiles. Okay. And today there are Armenian shops that sell these tiles. There's a lot of fake, right? You walk around in the market in the shuk of the old city, you'll see a lot of fake, but the real ones use the really deep, gorgeous colors. The Karkashians still have a store in Jerusalem, and the Balians have a store on Derech Shechem. There's another family called the Sandruni family. And so they are still carrying on this legacy. Okay. So now we have to look at questions, and then we're going to talk a little about the Diaspora Yeshiva. And I'm sure Batya is going to want to share with us. Okay, so we answered why the Armenians come. We answered about shooting at the walls. What happened to the prisoners of war who went to Jordan? Thank God it was not so easy. I won't say it was a wonderful time, but they are there for less than a year. And they come back. As far as I know, everybody came back. I could be incorrect. There could be maybe one or two who died, but I'm pretty sure that everyone came back. As things go, it was a better outcome than in many other situations. In 1947, 48 and onwards, the Yishuv fought to create a state. Okay. Thank you. I don't know why that's here, but fine. The old city, right?
How long were they there?
How long were they there? Less than a year. There's a fighting force smuggled into the old city beforehand who fought valiantly, including the son of the Nazir. This is very true, right? They did fight very valiantly. They were completely outnumbered, right? There's a famous story about how when Moshe Rusnak, who was the commander of the Jewish quarter, he was all of 24 years old. He was the commander of the Jewish quarter. And when they come to surrender in Batei Machsa, and the Jordanians have them line up, right? This fighting force, and he sees what they look like. He says, wow, that's how many of you there are. We could have come with sticks and not guns, right? So they were very valiant, but they were incredibly, incredibly outnumbered and out firepowered. Someone says, I met a fighter who was taken to Jordan. That's very cool, right? But yes, it was not very long, thank God. Kaiser Wilhelm was the German emperor. Thank you for the correction. What did they convert from? Remind me, Susanna, what were we talking about? I don't remember. You'll tell me.
Yeah, okay. So they converted to Christianity.
Armenian.
Oh, they were pagans. They were pagans and they became Christians, right? That's most of the converts to Christianity were pagans. Mount Ararat, right? Mount Ararat, just like the Mount Ararat we have in Tanakh. German genocide began in Namibia in the early 1900s. Okay, I don't know that story, but I will look into it. Israel has a close relationship with Azerbaijan, which has a fraught relationship with Armenia. Yes, there are definitely political considerations. It doesn't make it nice, but there are political considerations, which I can understand. Are yeshivas the best use of land overlooking and near the Kotel? I don't know if it's the best use of land. It's what happened, right? And we want to come back to the old city and we want to revive Jewish life there. Okay. So a little bit, a word about the Diaspora Yeshiva. And if you want to add, Batya, I'm very happy for you to add, but I will reiterate what I said in the beginning before we talk about that. No class for the next 2 weeks. Armenians were Zoroastrians. Okay. So not pagan. You're right. I was not exact. Zoroastrians considered pagans? I'm not going to go into it. No class for the next 2 weeks. Important to remember. Diaspora Yeshiva. After the Six-Day War, Israel came back, and the Mount Zion had all of these strange things that were added to it. And one thing that kind of was joined on in the 70s was the Diaspora Yeshiva, which attracted a lot of Balei Tshuva, right? A lot of returnees to Judaism. And one of the things that they were very well known for was music, right? Was their band. Batya, I see you're like waiting. Okay. Their band, the Diaspora Yeshiva band, and they had concerts and a lot of people came. Today they own or have taken over a lot of the buildings on Mount Zion, for good and for bad. What would you like to add, my friend?
Okay. First of all, When we came in Elul, September 1970, they were already there. So they could have started maybe in 69. It was Rabbi Goldstein. You should always remember it, Tzaddik. And he was the basically started the first Chozer B'Tshuva yeshiva. And he went recruiting. And he looking for guys. And he found guys playing music. And then they started the band. And it was the best, some of the best Jewish music, I think, ever. And Rabbi Goldstein before then was a... taught in Chafetz Chaim in Queens. Actually, it was my husband's ninth grade teacher. And we've had other connections with the family, with American football here in Israel, Dafka, with one of his grandsons. And it's an amazing place. And they're the ones who've taken care of that little the little Holocaust museum. They adopted it.
They now are taking care of it. It's true. It's true. Although I'm ambivalent about them because I don't like what they've done in other parts of Hartzion. But yes, they definitely get credit for being this on the scene in this kind of like hippie world, and being able to speak to people who were searching. And that is a huge thing to be able to do. I agree with you. All right. Thank you, everybody. Shabbat Shalom. See you in December, Be'ezrat Hashem.
Thank you very much. Happy Thanksgiving.
You'll have time to you know, do all your Thanksgiving things.
Thank you so much. Fantastic.
Thanks.
You're welcome. Thank Goodbye. You. Have a Shabbat Shalom, everybody.
Thank you. Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you.